I guess this was, we just finished our fifth week. It was five chapters. We did a chapter a week, and you discussed it in your small groups. The way we've done it the first 4 weeks is I kind of introduced the chapter, we talked about it, and then you discussed it in your small groups. Kind of did it opposite this week because we had our 80th anniversary celebration last week. So we had your small groups discuss the chapter, and now I'm going to give you some of my thoughts on that this morning. I really like the first five verses. There's some stuff in here that is some of my favorite scripture. So I'm going to cheat a little bit and just do the first five verses this morning, and then maybe I'll finish up this chapter next week since it's our last week on this book anyway. If you want to follow along, I'm just going to read that, 1 John chapter 5, and those first five verses to start off. John wrote this. He says, "Everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ," and don't forget, Christ isn't his last name. That means Messiah, the Anointed One. "Anybody who believes that is born of God. And everyone who loves the Father loves his child as well. This is how we know that we love the children of God, by loving God and carrying out his commandments." And here's a great verse here. "This is love for God, to obey his commands, and his commands are not burdensome. For everyone born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, even our faith. Who is it that overcomes the world? Only he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God." John just kind of continues with the theme that he's had all throughout this book, and he just hammers it again this week. Really, the theme of his book, I think, could be encapsulated. One of the best verses, I think, comes out of chapter 2, verse 33, that really kind of just encapsulates the whole theme of this book. And it's kind of a twofold command that Jesus gave that John is just really trying to help us to get it when he wrote this letter. And he said this: "This is the commandment, number one, that we believe in the name of the Son Jesus, of his Son Jesus Christ, and number two, that we love one another, just as he has commanded us." So I'm going to just kind of unpack how John goes into that in a little different angle in this section of these five verses. The first verse here of this section that we read, he says this: "Everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves the Father loves his child as well." Well, that makes sense, right? Pete, do you love your child? You bet. There's something about when you have your own kid, and it doesn't matter whether it's biological or adopted, you can't help it. You're crazy about them. I mean, sometimes when they get older, you wish you could detach a little bit, but you just can't. You never stop being a parent, right, Mary? No matter how old your kids get, you're always a parent. You always love them. You're always crazy about them. And that's what John is trying to get us to understand here. He's saying that whoever loves the Father is going to love his child. And in other words, maybe one way we could look at what he's saying here is if you have a kid, and then the only thing that maybe could compete with how much you love that kid is one other group that may love it just as much or may even compete with you how much that the parents love it, and that would be the grandparents. Right, Arlene? And so whoever loves the father loves the child. And in that sense, we could say you love the father, and then the father, your son has a kid, and then you love that kid. So if you love God the Father, Jesus said, you need to love me because I'm his son. And John takes it even further and says you need to love the son's kids. We've got the father's only begotten son, Jesus, whom you need to love if you love his father. And you also need to love the son's kids, which makes it a little harder Because that means you got to love me and I got to love you. I mean, it's one thing to love God because he's perfect. So it's not as hard. You know what I mean? He doesn't do anything wrong. He even sent his only son that he had to die for me. And it's not so hard to love his son either because he's the one who died for me. But to take it the next step and then to have to love me or you, well, unfortunately, I'm not perfect and you're not perfect. And I don't want to be nasty, but let's face it. Sometimes we annoy each other. Sometimes we can be a little inconsiderate and act a little selfish and drive each other crazy. But John says, listen, you can't claim to love God who you can't see and then claim to love your brother who you can see. You can't have it both ways. You can't love God and hate me, and I can't love God and be annoyed and hate you. It's just the way it is. It's a package deal. See, in the world, you can pick your friends. You know, you can decide, you know, and we have different reasons how we pick our friends. Maybe somebody's more like us, and there's emotional reasons, and we just kind of connect with them, and all of that's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. And so you happen to hang out with that person more. Sometimes financial levels have something to do with it because, well, you know, they're kind of on the same financial level as you, and you know, they're not that needy, or as a matter of fact, maybe they can even help you in certain ways, so it's kind of nice to hang out with them. In general, we pick people to hang out with that are easy and enjoyable. But God is more interested in building us up and others spiritually, so he doesn't just put people in our life to increase our comfort and our pleasure. He does, but he also puts those other kind of people in our life as well because he's interested in more than just making our life comfortable and pleasant. Proverbs 27:17, very familiar verse for a lot of people where it says, iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. And in the same way, you could take friction with metal against the other and you can sharpen it or you can polish it. Many times, friction between our personalities is what sharpens our character and polishes our spiritual character. And John says that we're not just to tolerate each other. I mean, the world is big on tolerance, right? Well, the church, John says, is supposed to go a step further. We're not even big on tolerance. We're supposed to be big on love. And you're not just supposed to tolerate your spiritual relatives. You're supposed to love them. And so you think, well, how are we going to pull this off? John says the answer in the very next verse, verse 2. After that, he says, this is how we know that we love the children of God. Okay. Here's the way you can know. Here's how you're going to pull it off. By loving God and carrying out his commands. We talked a little bit about that in a small group because I thought it was kind of interesting because in the book of this letter that John writes, he spends a lot of time saying loving God's kids, right, is the most practical sign that shows that you love God. But now he reverses it. And he says here, he turns it around and he says that loving God is the most practical way to love his kids. Well, how does that work? Well, do you remember in the last chapter we read in chapter 4, verse 8, it says that God is love. So if he's left out of the equation, you'll never be able to really love anybody. And that's a little harsh, but if God is love, he's left out of the equation, then the only thing left is some kind of cheap sentimental imitation because he's the genuine product. And John is saying, don't do that. You don't want to just love anybody if you don't love God. You have to love God first. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God. If you don't love God, then you can't do anybody really any ultimate good. I mean, we could feed them and we can clothe them and we can make them more comfortable. But Jesus said, you know, that's great. And, you know, we love that adage that says they don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. And if you genuine love people, you're going to want to do those things. But ultimately, Jesus also said, what good is it if they gain the whole world and lose their own soul? The bottom line is, if you don't love God, you can't love people in a way that counts for eternity. Okay, so we go on to verse 3, and he says this. This is love for God, to obey his commands, and his commands are not burdensome. Some other translations say they're not difficult. They're not hard to follow. It's not a burden or difficult or hard to keep God's commands. And, of course, the main one is to love each other. He says it shouldn't be burdensome if we have this love for God. When you really love someone, it's not this burdensome thing to please them. Again, I go back to the parents thing. We went to Alyssa's spring recital this last Tuesday. And I think the best example is with the real little kids. You know, you get the pre-K kids. They're like maybe 3, 4, 5 years old. And let's face it, they can barely speak in full sentences, let alone really sing a full measure of music. You know, I mean, their recital is just one step short of total chaos. You know, it was a Christian school, so it was biblical, and that it was from the book of Genesis where it says it was formless and void. You get the kids and they're looking out and they're laughing, they're waving at their parents, and then you get the one kid who actually does know the words and he dominates the mic, right? This little light of mine. You can't hear any of the other kids. And then they forget the words, and then the only one you can hear is the teacher in the front, stressing out, trying to get them back on track. You know? And then they finish the song, and all the parents give them a standing ovation. I mean, they're taking pictures. It's like Halley's Comet just came through the room, you know? But actually, it's something more powerful that came into the room. It's love. And that's why they do that. And it's not a burden. It's not a pain in the neck. Because they love their kids. When you love God, it's not a burden to do things for him that please him. I mean, probably one of my most popular examples is just when I fell in love. You know, when any guy falls in love. And when I first realized that I was taking the fall, it was after a Bible study, and I saw Tina, and I didn't want to be too obvious, you know, so I was like, well, what are you guys doing after the Bible study, you know? And most of you know the three things that I can't stand is shopping. Now, the other stuff I've gotten better at, but shopping, organic food and yogurt, you know? I just hated that. So I was like, so, Tina, what are you guys doing after the study? Oh, we're going to go shopping for yogurt at the organic health food store. Would you like to come? I've been waiting for somebody to ask me to go there. That's fantastic. It's not a burden. It's not a hassle because you're in love. When you're in love with Jesus, he says his commands aren't burdensome. I mean, you get weird when you fall in love with Jesus. You actually want to go to a prayer meeting. I mean, we said that Friday night. We said, isn't this weird? I mean, it's supposed to be Friday night. And we are looking forward to gather around a table and study the Bible. Something shifts in you when you're born anew and no longer are his commands a burden. And if they are, my old pastor used to say, well, then, brother, you need another dip. You know, you just need to dip back into the Spirit of God and get back to that place. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and they're not difficult. They're not burdensome. This is what it's all about, to keep his commandments, and they're not tough. It's all part of that love relationship. And you know what? We obviously don't keep a perfect track record, and that's what's so cool, too, because when you're God's kids, just like those parents at the concert, you know, even when your song is a little out of tune, he still gives you a standing ovation. And when a father loves you like that, you can't help but love him back. We love him, John said earlier in this same book, right? Because he loves us. It's not a burden to do what he asks. Now, verse 4 tells us one of the reasons we're freed up to willingly follow him. It says, because everyone born of God overcomes the world. One of the ways that we're freed up to follow God's ways is when we really love God and experience a genuine new spiritual birth, the spell of the world is broken and it loses its power. We're no longer drawn into the world's system. The world has this way of getting us to believe that its ways are better than the Bible's ways. And you know, and Paul wrote, he said, you know, the natural mind doesn't receive the things of the Spirit because some of this stuff looks crazy. Love your enemies, you know, just pray for those that despitefully use you. Love your neighbor as much as you do yourself. I mean, how can this stuff work? And what happens is we can subtly, even as Christians, where it's a battle, isn't it? You're always being subtly brought back in to the world system, and we have to be aware of that. I was thinking about some of the things that I get caught back into. You know, with all the stuff going on right now, as most of you know, with my daughter getting married, and I mean, it's like a tornado in our house, trying to stay on top of everything. And you've heard that, right? Busy being under Satan's yoke. It's just like, I think one of the things of the world system is just rushing everywhere. I mean, I get in that place now, and it's like when I pull up to a traffic light, I'm immediately analyzing the vehicles and which one will be able to take off from the light quicker than the other ones, you know? You don't want to pull up behind the truck. Definitely not the school bus. You know, oh, there's a motorbike. Great. Get right behind him, and we can head right out, you know? You head into the grocery store, and I'm immediately analyzing which line looks like it will move quicker because it's all about time, you know? And then you get in the line, and you're still not sure it's the right one, so you pick the person where you would have been, that would have been me person in the other line, and see if you still pick the right one, you know? Because you want to feel good that you're optimizing all your time. I mean, we don't go to places necessarily to eat because they're healthy food. We go because they have fast food. And of course, it's not fast enough. So they have, who's got time to park their car and go in? So they gave us the drive-through, you know? I mean, it's insane. Everything is hurry, hurry. I read about a pastor who was just getting swept up like so many of us do in this system of rush and more and trying to cram more stuff into less time. And he just was he's on the verge of burning out. And he called a fella who he felt was like his spiritual mentor. And he said, listen, he goes, I can feel the complacency coming on my heart. I'm just, I'm running at breakneck speed, and I just need you to help me, you know. What do you suggest? And there was like a silence, a pause for a little while. And then his mentor said, you have to ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. And then he just paused again afterwards. And then after a while, the pastor had called him up impatiently. He says, okay, I got that one. You have another. I got to get going. He wanted to cram in as many units of spiritual wisdom in the least amount of time possible. The danger isn't that a hurried lifestyle is, this is important. You need to understand, we're not saying that if you get caught up in this thing, that somehow it's going to cause you to renounce you know, your faith, and you'll somehow become an atheist because you became so busy. But what it will do is it gets us to settle for a mediocre version of our Christianity. We get ripped off. The world system rips us off. And listen to what John says later in this chapter about the world. He says, we know that we are the children of God, and that the whole world is under the control of the evil one. That's a massive statement. Something to keep in mind, you know? And I just thought about all this rushing and hurrying, and then I thought, you know what? And, you know, this preaching stuff stinks because you come up with these great ideas, but you know you've never actually done them yourself, you know? So it's like, okay, yeah, that's a pretty good idea, but I guess I'm going to have to try it now because I'm going to recommend it to the congregation. But, like, you go into a supermarket, and instead of being so obsessed with getting through the fastest line, how about saying a prayer? And God, which line should I get in? Maybe there's somebody, and not to get faster time, you know, but maybe there's somebody he wants me to talk to. You know, maybe there's somebody that just needs to be encouraged today. Let them know that they're not alone. It doesn't have to be a great closing deal witness, but just maybe something, a little scripture, or just letting them know that you just kind of felt on your heart, you wanted to remind them that God hasn't forgotten about them, and he's real involved with their life, even though maybe they don't realize it. You know what it is? Hurry inhibits our ability to love other people. I mean, when I get on the street, man, and somebody's car's broken down, I have to admit that most of the time I view that broken down car as an object that is actually inhibiting my ability to get where I have to go on time. Maybe I should just take a minute, make sure the person has a cell phone, and that they're okay. And maybe God would open a door to talk to them a little bit. Here's one thing I saw, man. This is important. It says the world's system has gotten us to take time more seriously than eternity. Even as a pastor, I find myself more obsessed with getting through stuff in a timely fashion than the eternal destiny of somebody's soul. What are we in a hurry for anyway? Usually it's for work, food, and stuff. And that's kind of how it works, right? You go to work so you can make money, so you can buy food and get stuff. And meanwhile, I live in a world where, on a percentage scale, I have more stuff than the vast majority of most of the population of the globe, and yet I'm still convinced that I don't have enough. And the problem is, the more I need, or at least the more I think that I need, the less I'm able to love others with my money, because I've spent it all on myself. Got all these things that I'm convinced I have to have, and sometimes I even overspend, so there's nothing left to love God's people with. John says I need to focus on God and his way of doing things to overcome these systems of the world that want to take control of my life instead of God. John says this is how we do it. This is the victory, he says, that has overcome the world, even our faith. It takes faith that God's ways are better than the world's and that they actually work. It takes faith when you're in a hurry somewhere, but you still take a few minutes to do whatever you feel God is telling you, whether it's to check with somebody on the side of the road or it takes faith to pray and not be so obsessed with my hurriedness to see if maybe God has something for me in BJ's besides trying to get out of there in a timely fashion. And it takes faith to put aside money every week for something besides my own financial well-being and put it in the plate to invest it in God's kingdom here and across the world. You may feel like asking, but man, you know, it's tough to just pull all this stuff off. Can we really do that? And that's okay, because John asked the same question. He says, who is it that overcomes the world? Who is it? Here it is again. He believes that Jesus is the Son of God. If you believe in Jesus, you have access to spiritual resources that is all that is necessary to no longer live under the burdensome oppression of the crazy pressure that the world tries to make you feel. Here's what Paul said, 1 Corinthians 2:12. We have not received a spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we may understand what God has freely given us. It's a spiritual thing, people. And that's what I want to leave you with. Check out what the psalmist has to say in Psalm 27:4. I think it's a great remedy for us coming under the oppression of the world system in whatever way it's gotten you. Maybe you related to some of the stuff that I deal with. I'm sure we all have our own things that the world is always trying to press us and conform it into its mold. Here's what the psalmist said. One thing I have asked from the Lord, that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to meditate in his temple. The psalmist narrows it down to just one thing. Just seeking God. Taking time and praying. You know, Martin Luther, who read the Reformation, is probably nobody busier than that guy. And he said he couldn't afford to spend at least 3 or 4 hours every morning in prayer. He couldn't afford to not spend at least 3 to 4 hours every morning to start his day off, because he saw the remaining hours were so much more productive when he started it off with God. And listen, I'm not saying there's no way, you got to walk before you can run. Just try at least 15 minutes, and it may be tough. Break out the Bible. Ask God to show you something in his word as you pray. Sometimes it helps people just to put on Christian music, something, you know, the stuff that you hear here on Sunday morning, or whatever it is that inspires you to get you into that spiritual mode and just seek God. But here's the thing. The psalmist says, it's one thing that I desire. And in our world, I mean, we've really gotten good at doing many things at once, right? What they call multitasking, right? We can, I don't know, be texting and talking on the phone. You got the TV going and whatever it is. And we've really mastered the ability. I was thinking about this one night when we were at our prayer meeting. Just mastered the ability to do many things at once. But I think in so doing, we've lost the ability to do just one thing. Man, does anybody ever shut off their cell phone anymore? Turn off the TV and all of that garbage and just do one thing. I mean, what does it matter in the end when it's all over? One thing I seek, the Lord, and to be with him and to behold the beauty of the Lord. Loving God, loving others is what John says, and getting out from the stressful bondage of the world system in a way where it's not the difficult burden or task, but it's the natural expression of where you're at. And you know what? As you spend time with God, he may not change your situation, we often say, but something better might even happen. He just might change you. And you'll be able to receive spiritual resources to handle your situation and perhaps even see it differently from his perspective. Right? What do they say? Situations that happen to us It's 10% the situation and 90% how we react to it that makes a difference. If we can just have that one thing, I'm convinced it makes a difference. Let's pray.